Hello, this is recording number 4 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Chapter 4, page 30. Pain was the only sensation that could penetrate his brain. It was at least a sign that he was alive, and Gord accepted it as such. How long he could hold his position he did not know. But he was determined not to admit defeat and to persevere until Fergo said he could stop. That there were several others undergoing the same torture was indeed consolation to Gord. Perhaps if one of them broke first, he would follow, but until then he was determined to endure. What the youth was suffering was simply training. Training to be a contortionist. To be able to assume the guise of a maimed and hopeless cripple. Part of the education necessary to field a corps of beggars, each so pitiful and pathetic that the hardest-hearted passerby would have ruth and drop a drab or two into one's bowl. Break. Well, here we're given to see the beginning of the beggar's training. There's a mention of Fergo as the instructor. And Gord, his determination is shown. But also, it is the training that is perhaps most worthy of note. The idea that there's a corps of beggars under Theobald, the beggar master's command. But also the idea in what seems a fairly heartless city, that the beggars are still able to get passerbys, that there is at least some people who are not quite so heartless as most of those who have been detailed in the earlier parts of the book, will drop a coin or two into the bowl of a beggar. All right. This also goes to show the early training that the beggar is almost could almost be considered some kind of NPC class, the beginnings of Gord's education as something more than just a simple thief, but also as the beginning of a classed character in game terms. All right, restart. Page 30, paragraph 3. Each morning, Gord began the day with exercises. Calisthenics that kept his young body lean and supple. If he did well, he was then allowed to break his fast with the dozens of other apprentices and journeyman beggars quartered in the beggar master's building. Failure to please meant no food, at best, but Gord preferred not to think about that. Following the meal came lessons in the secret sign of the beggars, a means of communication that was supposedly unknown to the uninitiated, an amalgam of the thieves' cant and the secret speech of the merchant's guild that had been perverted to the ends of the lowly beggars' union. Thereafter came more physical training, and then mental disciplines once again, usually memory training, and then lessons in assessing people. Break. All right, now, two things of good note here is, one, we learned that there is a beggar's language. We're told again of the thieves' cant, and this, it was called, I believe, before the merchant's cant, but they're here, the secret speech of the merchant's guild, which is basically the same thing. And now we're named that the beggar master, his organization is the beggar's union. So we have the Thieves Guild, the Merchants Guild, the Beggars Union, but all, speaking of the way these things are structured. Now, I'd noted previously that that the Beggars Union here seems to be a very organized, so in game terms, like very lawful or orderly, and hardly a kind of chaotic organization. So here we're given the rather, strenuous, the mental and physical training just for the beggars. And that really speaks to a pretty highly disciplined organization that is going on here. Other than that, it gives a little bit about how how severe the punishments are, and what a rough life that Gord is living right here, training him up, using his what are exceptional abilities, but training those in various ways with the calisthenics, the contortions, the disguises, the mental disciplines, and here where they're learning lessons in assessing people. So it almost seems like if we look back at what we've seen, that Clyde the Sharper, he assesses Gord. Gord himself naturally has this ability in assessing Theobald's sadism and how he let that come out so that he would appease Theobald. Theobald and Fergo being able to assess Gord. And Fergo very quickly seeing that Gord had done that disguise as a someone with the a plague so that he could avoid work in the workhouse. All right. I'm then going to restart. This is page 31, paragraph 2. Gord was quick to learn, and the lessons gladdened his heart. Skills and knowledge he was gaining were tools that would enable him to break out of the prison of the slum, the old city, and become something far greater than a successful beggar, let alone a beggar's apprentice. The actual goal was a secret, one kept closely among the chosen of the Mager Master, and Gord had earned his way into that select group. As he fought with body and mind to keep the pain from getting the best of him, Gord began to silently recall what he had learned and experienced in the days recently gone by. All right, break. Now, this is the first hint right here of something going on and why the beggars are being taught in such severe discipline and this training that goes beyond what you might think the beggars would actually need. So there is some secret, and it also speaks of how Gord, we don't know how much time has passed, but Gord is a quick learner, and he has now made his way into this select group keeping this secret. All right. Now, it gives his a look at what a terrible place it is in the slum and the old city. Hardly surprising, but, we just note right there that that section of the city of Greyhawk, if you were going to do a campaign there, you might want a lighter, less grim campaign, but you can see that Gygax thought of the slum and the old city as quite a terrible place, and he's written about quite terrible people there. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 31. There's a small break, and it is paragraph 3. Those who dwelt with the Beggar Master were unlike other members of the Beggar's Union. The latter simply paid a tithe to the Master in return for a select location and the promise of aid when in trouble. But those indentured to the Beggar Master had to turn over every iron drab, bronze Z, or food scrap they'd garnered. After 2 months of service and general instruction inside Theobald's mansion, Gord had been sent out with a group of other apprentices and journeymen under the watchful eyes of a pair of master beggars. Since he did well in his efforts to swell the beggar master's coffers, he was allowed to go on more of these field trips, and he soon developed a well-deserved reputation as a good scavenger. Whether he went out in the morning or evening, in new city or old, Gord had managed to come back with more coins and food than any of the others. Of course, sometimes he had had to resort to theft when soulful pleading for alms had failed to net what he felt would be an acceptable take. Early in his career, Gord had been beaten once for failure, and he vowed to himself that such would never happen again. Break. All right. Now, this paragraph, we're actually given quite a few little things here. I've been noting before about the coinage. We'd been introduced early on to the iron drab. We know that there is the copper common. We've heard that silver is coined, and they had mentioned bronze. Now, in this paragraph, we see that it is the iron drab, the bronze Z. So here we have another part of the coinage of the city of Greyhawk: iron drab, bronze Z, copper common. They've all been named, and those normally we see the copper as the lowest kind of coinage, but in the city of Greyhawk we have the iron drab and bronze Z below the copper common. All right. Now we're also we're told a little more about the beggars union here. We have dozens of people who are attending, living in the mansion. So that speaks to me of at least, say, 36 or more beggars who are living in the mansion. If we look at, you know, dozens as a plural, and hopefully a plural that is three or more, we're looking at about 36 or more, at the very least, of these beggars in the mansion. But we also, those are the indentured beggars. Those are the ones that have been sold to Theobald or are of special note to Theobald. Outside of the mansion, there are beggars who are just paying a tithe, who are members of the beggars' union, but are not living in there, and they're not required to give all their all over to Theobald. They're just paying their tithe to be in the union. All right, that shows you that the beggars' union is a much much larger organization than, you know, well, it starts to show the size of the beggars' union. All right. Now, we hear of the new city, how Gord is sent out, and he's sent out not only to the old city, where the takings would probably be lower, and off to the areas of Greyhawk referred to as new city. We learn here that Gord, there's a sense that time has passed here, perhaps a substantial amount, as Gord has risen from, failing once and then being sent out after his training. And now he's become, even though he's an apprentice, he is now one of the most accomplished beggars, or the most accomplished of the beggars, bringing in the most coin and scraps and scavenging. Again, it is good background material if you are looking into developing the beggar's union, or doing something in your campaign with the beggar's union, and seeing that it is much more than just simply like another guild. There's quite a bit of substance being described here about the Beggars Union. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 31, last paragraph. Continued success brought the reward of being initiated into the Beggar Master's inner circle. Each initiate swore an oath never to reveal, on penalty of death, the secret of the circle. When Gord was accepted as a member, he learned that the master was dissatisfied with his alliance with the Thieves Guild. The arrangement between the groups was simple. Each beggar kept his eyes, or his or her eyes, open for any likely prospects, signaling a mark to a nearby thief, or bringing back word about potential targets for burglary or robbery. In return, a thief always gave to a beggar he encountered on the street, and a successful escapade by a thief meant a tithe from the Thieves Guild to the Beggars Union. However, this tithe was only one-tenth of that portion of the take paid by the thieves to their guild. Thus, if 100 silver nobles were lifted from someone's strongbox, the thief would pay the customary one-tenth share to the guild, and of these 10 coins, the beggar master got 1. This was insufficient. Master of beggars, Theobald, would have it all. Break. So here we have what is going on as the secret of the beggars' union is the dissatisfaction of Theobald with really a 1% share in the take that his beggars had helped to set up of anything stolen by the Thieves' Guild. We see the, but in that we see the structure of how the beggars and the thieves, they have this alliance, and how the beggars are acting as the spotters for the Thieves' Guild. So the beggars are throughout the city, set in place or wandering, and under the eye of the merchants in the city watch, they're helping to supply the Thieves' Guild with the information they need for burglary and robbery and other targets. All right. Now, the other thing is, if we're looking at coinage, here we go, and here is the another named currency. We have the Iron Drab, the Bronze Z, the Copper Common, and now the Silver Noble. So we have 4 types of coinage for the city of Greyhawk named right now as something unique to Greyhawk, to the city of Greyhawk. All right. Restart, page 32, paragraph 2. The scheme was simple. The beggar master had enlisted renegade thieves, promising to pay them handsomely for their services. These professionals then trained the most promising beggars and the arts and crafts of thievery. Now there existed a cadre of beggars who were as skilled at cutting purses, picking pockets, and filching valuables as any of the rogues roaming the city under the auspices of the Thieves' Guild. Their original instructors had disappeared in the meantime, so now only those whom the beggar master had in his palm knew the secret. It was whispered among the talented apprentices that someday they would be the leaders of a host of beggar thieves who would vanquish the guild and make any surviving thieves swear fealty to the beggars' union. For the time being, they must all bring in coins by the sackful so that assassins and mercenaries could be enlisted when the master decided the time had come. Break. All right, now here is the plan. Here is that we are the beggar master Theobald. Here is the beginning of this campaign adventure that I personally found very enjoyable to run. I ran over a year and a half of the Thieves Guild beggar union war within the city of Greyhawk. And we have assassins and mercenaries mentioned here. And we have here for Gord, we're looking at his early skill trainings that perhaps go beyond what's normal for thieves, but here he is going to be a beggar thief and later turned into perhaps something different, never something I'm quite aware of that I'm aware of as part of the game system, but there were a change in what the regular thief could do more as a rogue, and there had been, I believe, the tumbler. And all these things, they're foreshadowed right here in what the beggar master is doing to change his beggars over into something more and hopefully and become not just a second Thieves Guild, but to overmaster the Thieves Guild, becoming the beggars union of beggars thieves. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 32. Here is a small break. This is paragraph 3. Rest! Fergo shouted, and all the apprentices but Gord collapsed on the floor, grimacing and gasping. With his reverie broken, but his resolve intact, the youth slowly lowered his left leg from its position behind his back, and brought his right arm as slowly down to his side, flexing both to restore full circulation, but with out apparent effort or pain. "You there on the floor," said Fergo, Observe Gord. He isn't whining or wheezing. That's how you should all be. On your feet for more exercise now. For a break, we'll practice on the blade dummy later. Break. All right, now here we're shown the training that they're getting in more detail, a blade dummy, the contortions, but we're also shown right here how Gord is a cut above the other trainees and being used as an example by Fergo, the instructor, on what the others should be doing. All right, restart. This is page 32, and I'm beginning the last paragraph. As they groaned quietly and darted hateful looks at Gord, the other boys and girls of the group arose and returned to training. Although all wore beggar's rags, each was clean beneath the garments. Gord hadn't liked the bathing at first, but it was not optional. At times they would be required to assume a role other than that of a crippled, maimed, or diseased beggar. Looking dirty was easy, but pretending to be an honest citizen of standing was not. Light stretching and bending exercises were easy compared to what they had been through before them, and they would help a lot when dealing with the test of the blade dummy. The apprentices took to the calisthenics with vigor, for all feared what was coming and wanted to be as prepared as they could be. The blade dummy was one of many mannequins used for training. The simplest was just a dummy for beginner's practice. A different one was mounted on a pedestal and slowly turned to make it difficult to approach. Yet another was covered with bells, so that the slightest miscue would be pickpocket caused a jingling. Break. Now, here, and I should have noted before, they were learning specific thieves skills, such as pickpocketing and cutting purses. Always something mentioned in the rules is the skills of the thieves. And here we show that Gord is being trained, and the other beggar apprentices are being trained with some classical things like the blade dummy and the dummy with the bells, but also how they're smart enough that they know that they want them to be able to assume roles very quickly. So, like they said, even though they appear dirty and in rags, beneath all that, they're always clean so that they can assume a more wide variety of roles, such as a honest citizen or one of standing. It also shows that even though Gord is exceptional, all of the apprentices are taking to these strenuous training, perhaps the rest are saying that they're out of fear of what was coming, but for Gord, he's also sees the possibilities of becoming someone more skilled, where it can lead him out of the slums and out of the old city. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 33, paragraph 3. The blade dummy was the worst. Its robe girdle and tunic pockets were lined with razor blades, positioned differently each time the thing was set up. As an instructor counted, each trainee had to take a turn at testing sleeve, breast, pocket, and worst of all, the purse tucked into the girdle, while a slip in some other area would inflict a painful cut. Purse was a double challenge. To get it free without encountering the blade surrounding it was difficult. And if it was removed too hastily, with too much force, or clumsily, then a spring blade from the girdle would scythe upward. A hand slowly pulled away would be gashed, or even severed, if its owner was too hesitant. All of the apprentices were too quick to be seriously hurt, so long as they were careful. But it was hard to be confident about the blade dummy, and the strain was terrible. Break. All right, well, we're given here a more detailed account of the training they're getting with the blade dummy and its construction. We're also see that when we have such a harsh, potential injury coming from using that blade dummy, where they might even get a severed hand, and then what use would they be except as a true beggar? The training here has reached a level of quite a level here where the damage done could be crippling to the apprentices. But we're also told that the apprentices at this point are too quick, showing that they have reached a higher level of training. This reemphasizes the sense of time passing, that Gord is changing, the other apprentices are changing, and that time is moving forward, even though we're really not told that. We're not told if Gord's age beyond 12 at this point. We're not told how many weeks or months have passed, but there is a sense of in this this skilled training that time has passed since Gord was sold to the beggar master. All right, I'm going to restart here. This is page 33, the last paragraph. Eventually, that exercise ended, and this time there was no bloodshed at all. The students were indeed getting better. The subsequent practicing of stealthy movement, concealment, and lockpicking was just easy routine. Lessons in assessing the valuables of an individual, what was carried and where, how to observe a place for future burglary, and so forth, filled the remainder of the long afternoon. Virgo was a hard taskmaster, and other experts who occasionally took their turns at instruction were just as demanding. After supper was time for letters, learning to write, spell, read, change hands to write with the other, and draw, and the seemingly endless copying of plans, maps, documents, and books. Break. All right. Now, here we're seeing how advanced this training has gotten. The thieves are starting off, and they all seem to be young. They're called boys and girls. So they all seem to be a pretty young group who's reached this higher level of skilled training. But they're also learning. They're learning to read and write. They're learning to assess valuables. They're learning the regular thieves skills of stealthy movement, concealment, and lockpicking. So they are becoming apprentice thieves. And at this point, we could probably look at them as zero-level thieves getting their training, getting experience, and moving their way up to being level one thieves if we were looking at the game. I'm going to break right here. I'm sorry. I already broke. I'm going to restart, and it is page 34, paragraph 2. Even more than he enjoyed all of this in-house learning, Gord liked the two market days, for then the apprentices were sent forth to put into action the skills they had learned. Tomorrow was a field day, and anticipation of the jaunt was uppermost in the minds of all the apprentices as they bade each other good night at the end of the evening's lessons. Break. All right. Now, this shows that this inner circle, that the ones that are being trained as the beggar thieves, and it does where he's looked back and before the regular beggars, they go out every day and they beg, they come back, they turn in their earnings, they get food and lessons and then to bed. But these, they're only going out 2 days a week, where they get to go out but they get to practice their skills. So, like we learn from the regular game setting, here we get the experience and then the training to make use of that experience. And so they're going out and twice a week, they're going out and getting this experience they need to work their way to probably what would be first level thieves. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 34, paragraph 3. "What's the big deal about tomorrow?" asked Hottie, a tiny fellow of only 7 or 8 years of age, as he dogged Gord's heels while they searched the stairway. The youngster was a newcomer, and had not yet been on an excursion outside the master's walls. Gord looked wise and winked at the little waif. "Don't you worry none about it, laddie boy. It's soon enough you'll be learning." Break. All right, now, here we have, I mean, this seems pretty exceptional, that now we have a 7 or 8 year old who is in part of one of these beggar thief classes and already has this this training. He's named as Hottie, and we also have Gord, who is acting more like even the use of that laddie boy, like Clyde the Sharper or Fergo or Batcrap the Cook, who all kind of have that same way of talking. And so we can see where Gord is learning not just these skills, but he's learning how to act in that society of beggar thieves. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 34. It is paragraph 5. Hottie didn't know whether to grin or not at such words. As close as they were to those he heard continually from Master Fergo, he started to ask more, but Gord waved him off, and Hottie shuffled discontentedly to his own place above. Gord liked the little fellow, and that was saying a lot, for Gord had but two other such comrades in the whole place. Hottie thought him big, strong, and smart. As far as Gord knew, that made Hottie different from all the others in the beggar master's decrepit palace. Of course, Gord was often congratulated for his cunning, stealth, and even good thinking, but somehow he didn't take such great pride in being praised for clever begging or thievery. Hottie's adulation was for Gord as a person, not for anything in particular he did. Break. All right, well, here we see Gord is, changing quite a bit in character. He's receiving praise. He's receiving this admiration from the young thief, much different from the Gord of the slum quarter, who was, on the verge there of not thinking that life was worth living anymore, who was scared all the time and hungry all the time, who was abused by the headsman and by his own foster mother, and the terrible situation that he was living in the slum quarter. So already we see that even though Gord is not, he is not shining out completely, he is being recognized for the skills that they want, like cunning, stealth, and good thinking, by the people in authority. And he has, at least, besides Hottie, made two other comrades among the big group of beggar thieves. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 34, paragraph 7. Soon, the massive old structure was quiet. Practice rooms and the loft were empty. The two floors beneath were filled with sleeping beggars. The first floor, the offices of the Union, and the sprawling quarters of Master Theobald were silent, too. The obese beggar master was anxious that everyone be rested and alert so that all would go well on the morrow. Break. All right, now, I break here because one of the things we're given now, some of the structure and organization of the beggar's mansion. It's four stories. We had the loft described before as the big empty room. And we have the two floors beneath are filled with sleeping beggars. The first floor, the offices of the Union, and the quarters of Master Theobald, and that grand entrance salon that Gord was originally brought to. So we have a description here of kind of a little bit of what that structure looked like.
And the cellar is the kitchen.
Yeah, and the cellar would be the kitchen, so it would be the four upper stories and at least one lower, if not more. And it'd be interesting to see if this does match up with that TSR headquarters.
Yeah, it's very similar.
And not surprising. I mean, that did seem to be something that Gygax liked to do.
And you know, he said up in the loft there, it was a big open area where like the four main artists were.
And you know, it's interesting that he's kind of changed what the loft was, because originally Gord is brought to the loft and it's filled with cubicles and he goes to sleep in one of them.
Right.
And now it seems more like the loft is the training floor. Now, things could have changed,
right,
or there just could have been a change in what Gygax wanted the mansion to look like. He's now moved the middle two floors to be the sleeping quarters, and the upper floor to be, it seems more like that's where the practice rooms in the loft. And before, that upper floor was described as one big open space. So I don't know if that's a discontinuity here, or whether there might have been a change. Because like I've been saying, time has definitely passed, and I don't know if it was. I get the feeling that a substantial amount of time has passed since 12-year-old Gord is brought from the workhouse till this Gord here, who is now still an apprentice, but is the most successful of the apprentices. And is starting to become more confident, you know. And as they're saying, he is talking more and more like the Fergo, the trainers, the master. The Gord's voice is starting to assume not only part of that society, but the authorities in that society. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 34. Is the last paragraph. Before dawn the next morning, Gord and a score of other special apprentices were assembled. Each received instruction as to what he or she was to be that day. For this mission, Gord was teamed with Violet, a beautiful young girl of about 16. She was a whore. Gord liked her, for she had been nice to him from the first. Violet was a top earner and a favorite of Theobald, and Gord didn't like to think about that. He supposed she had been put in the special group originally because the beggar master liked her. Drake. Here we have, the young teenage prostitute Violet introduced. A little more of the rough edge of Gygax's Greyhawk, over what the published material is like. We have that she's Theobald's mistress, or at least, one of a girl that Theobald likes. And Gord kind of denigrates her a little bit because he's saying that he thinks that she was put in this beggar thief training because the beggar master liked her, rather than saying that the beautiful young La Violet is in there because she's skilled as the rest of the apprentices. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 35, paragraph 2. Gord was still naive at times. In reality, Violet was an accomplished actress and seasoned strumpet by the age of 13. Theobald simply knew talent, and that was why she was in the select group. She could pose as a pitiful young mother with a starving child, a vaguely pretty but crippled girl, an armless crone, or a striking doxy. Today she was the latter, posing as a courtesan from out of town, slumming, as it were, amid the merchants and artisans of the Garden Quarter sporting district. She shot Gord a smile, and his heart raced. Gord was beginning to feel new stirrings within himself of late, especially when he was around Violet. Break. Well, Gygax is kind of, you know, I mean, it was a different time, and he was kind of pushing things there. But again, you know, reflecting more medieval sensibilities than gaming sensibilities. And again, here we're shown that although Gord in some ways is growing up, in others he still shows his, like they say, his naivete. He doesn't recognize in Violet that she is talented and as the actress, but, you know, and that she can play all these various poses to help with their thieving. Or even as a skilled beggar. So, you know, she's earned her place among the special beggar thieves rather than Gord thinking she's put there just because she's the beggar master's paramour. Now, this is the first mention of the Garden Quarter, the merchants and artisans of the Garden Quarter, Quarter's sporting district. Now, that I'm not quite sure in the descriptions of the Garden Quarter, if this is the first time I note that a sporting district within the Garden Quarter, and whatever the sporting district might be, gambling, racing, arena, or whatever, that it is mentioned as being in the Garden Quarter. Now, it's also that the Garden Quarter itself is obviously not considered to be on the level of the aristocrats or the oligarchs who are ruling Greyhawk, the city of Greyhawk, because they refer to Violet being there as an out-of-town courtesan, slumming among the merchants and artisans of the Garden Quarter sporting district. Now, it could just be that the sporting district is the lowest, lowest area, or one of the lower areas, the lower class areas of the Garden Quarter, and that Garden Quarter might have higher class areas where the more rich and the powerful come. So the Garden Quarter itself could be a little, you know, have different, definitely as a district there, that is not considered to be on the right side of the tracks exactly. All right. I'm going to restart. This is page 35, paragraph 3. Dressed in ragged cloaks, the team slipped out of the building separately. Each group went its own way quietly, disappearing quickly so as not to elicit unwanted attention. Gord and Violet made their way quickly to an empty building nearby, slipping in through a side door. A beggar there accepted their hand signs and took them into the next room, where he moved a table and lifted a concealed trap door. Gord helped the girl descend the ladder-like stairway. At the bottom, some 20 or more feet beneath the streets above, was a secret passage that led under the wall dividing Old Town from New. There were gates to pass through, of course, but the cost was more than an iron drab for each pair of legs. Spies and watchers were at these places, too, and the beggar master wanted no reports of beggars moving to places where thievery would be reported later. Thievery for which the guild took no responsibility or paid no share to city officials. Already the guild was getting pressure to account for such activity, and suspicion of the thieves was rife. Neither could the new corps go in non-beggar's disguises, for obviously the whole scheme would come to light then. Thus hidden ways and quick changes in secret stations were used to throw any observers off the track. Break. Well, this is, you know, this is has a quite a bit of information right here. More description of the Beggars Union, which, you know, should be a nice, useful addition to a City of Greyhawk campaign, or even exported to other cities that might have similar beggars unions with, you know, different or similar motivations for, you know, different campaigns or adventures. We have the business with the secret tunnel, which makes quite a bit of sense, slipping from Old Town to New Town, that the beggars pay a tithe you know, pay off city officials, so that thievery itself is within the city, is not, it's a criminal activity, but with the Thieves Guild, it is an accepted criminal activity. And either official or bribery to the city officials is commonplace. And if not, just accepted. So we also have now that within this, if you're looking at what a campaign is doing, that the thievery and robbery and operations by the beggar master here, outside of begging, have started to throw the balance of the city into question, into problems with the suspicions against the Thieves Guild doing this unbribed or untied thievery, and it starts to show where the campaign can go, and you know, how it could even be taken in different directions from here, where it might not be a campaign of direct warfare, but one of this more subtle behind the scenes stirring up against the Thieves Guild, so that the beggars can come and take their place. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 35, last paragraph. After 100 or so paces, the pair came to a ladder. Violet ascended first, and Gord watched her from below, holding his candle so that he could view her shapely young legs. He began thinking of ways to be alone with her when they got back to their headquarters. Break. All right. Well, there we have the picture. And on, good to know, is on page 36, there is a full page Clyde Caldwell illustration of the 16-year-old Violet, I guess in her best courtesan gear, or, you know, her strumpet attire. Now, we also, we have some showing here that Gord seems to either be developing pretty young, or else, or else he is... more time than, say, weeks or months has passed, and he is developing into a young man. All right. I tend to think that they've kind of pulled a bit of an Anakin Skywalker here thing, where they start him out as fairly young, and very quickly within the text of the story, without saying that the time has passed, that he is either acting or actually being an older character at this point. All right, I am going to restart. This is page 37, paragraph 2. They changed in the room to which the ladder brought them. It was a small place hidden in the basement of the establishment of a pawnbroker. He was one of the beggar master's trusted henchmen, and made a fat profit from the goods he fenced for the burgeoning group of non-guild thieves. Violet's change was easy. She simply removed her cloak, revealing a fancy dress underneath, and took off her head wrap and shook out her hair. The soft, wavy, golden-brown tresses shone in the candlelight. Then she pulled several small items from the pockets of her cloak. An old cracked mirror enabled her to apply pigments to darken her eyes and rouge her cheeks. Next came jewelry. Fake stuff, naturally, but only an expert looking closely could tell that its worth was only coppers, not silver nobles. In the meantime, Gord had shed his dirty garments and donned hose, pantaloons, doublet, and short cape. He was the serving boy of the courtesan Panora, lately of Divers, but now considering making her home in the more cosmopolitan city of Greyhawk. In his role, Gord wouldn't be noticed, for Violet Panora would certainly command all eyes. His mission was to pick as many pockets and sneak as many purses and other valuables as he could. Break. All right. So in these two paragraphs, we're given more information about Violet and her looks and her, you know, her skill in disguise. Not really much, but just showing her natural beauty, but we're also given, more importantly, we show that Gord has now developed to the point where they've taught him to look like he can be a serving boy. So he's still young, or can still look very young, to the fake courtesan Panora. We have the first mention of divers, and a point that the city of Greyhawk is cosmopolitan. Now, we're also introduced to an unnamed pawnbroker who is a henchman of the beggar master, obviously across the wall in the new city. Now, this goes to show how far the beggar master, what power he has, that he's not just commanding the beggars. He's now commanding people who are, like the pawnbroker, who has an establishment. And it also shows that he is not only thieving, but selling the goods that he steals, so that he's less worried about discovery. It's a thoughtful plan that he has developed here. And yet, it still seems that this is the beggar thieves seem to be a new development, as they're referred to the burgeoning group of non-guild thieves. So it seems like Gord has joined this, the thieves, the beggars union, at a time when the beggar master is beginning the implementation of his plan, rather than it having been in existence long before he got there. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 37, paragraph 4. "This will be fun," thought Gord. Then he remembered that Violet would also be plying her original profession, and the day seemed less appealing than it had. But no matter, one had to work to survive, and this was work he enjoyed. Exiting the basement from a back door and melting into the throng on the street was a simple matter for them. Both knew how to avoid attention when they wanted to. Once past Odd Alley, they walked west to the processional and then turned north. Gord was excited and actually mingling as an equal with the folk who strolled along here. This was the major north-south artery of the city. Southward, it led to the Grand Square and the Citadel. They were going in the opposite direction toward the Garden Quarter. In a short time, they left the broad thoroughfare in favor of the narrower streets where the rich and famous commoners of the city dwelt. Blue Boar Street was renowned for its shops, its drinking and eating establishments, and the quality of the gentlefolk and rakes who frequented its curving length. Break. All right. Well, now here we're given a good description. Here we're the first mention of the Odd Alley, the processional, the Grand Square, the Citadel, the name Blue Boar Street. So here we're given a little more detail that can be used. Some of it just names that are dropped with a few comments about them. Odd Alley is mentioned first here. Processional, which is the main street through the city of Greyhawk, and I believe also in the box set, it's still the processional. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether they call Grand Square and the Citadel are named that in the set, but this definitely is the City of Hawks map. It would be very useful to look up a copy of at least the map while you're going through Saga of Old City. It really is something that would have been nice to be included. There is a map at the beginning of the book, but it is a regional map showing the area of the Flaness around the City of Greyhawk and where the adventures within this book might take place, although it does not show the whole Flaness. We're told here Again, Viola is still plying her profession as a courtesan, which upsets Gord, showing Gord's beginning feelings for her. Then we are also told that, the streets of this area of the city are thronged. Quite an active city, at least in this area. And then we're told a little bit about the Blue Boar Street in the Garden Quarter, or at least approaching, because it says in a short time they left the broad thoroughfare in favor of narrower streets where the rich and famous of the commoners dwelled. Not necessarily the Garden Quarter, but it could be. And then on Blue Boar Street, we're told it's a curving street, renowned for its shops, drinking, and eating establishment, and the quality of gentlefolk and rakes frequented it. All right, I am going to restart here. It is page 38, paragraph 2. Pausing here and browsing there, they proceeded along as would a well-heeled woman of high station, accompanied by her servant. Before they entered the Wizard's Hat Inn, Gord had managed to pinch a spider-silk kerchief and an ivory comb, lift a small purse from an incautious gentleman, fretting while his lady looked at material in a dressmaker's, and filch two silver pieces from the tunic of a prosperous lesser cleric. He had missed an opportunity or two, surely, but he did so by choice. If the prospect looked too alert, or too knowledgeable, the lad simply passed up having a go. Break. So here we see Gord has developed into quite a thief. Simply the spider silk kerchief and ivory comb would be, something of more value and a nicer material than they'd ever see in the slum quarter. Probably something in the foreign quarter, but still, here Gord casually is stealing them. He's able to slip two silver pieces. And if we've looked at the way the coinage goes, we have iron drabs, which can buy you in the slum quarter food for a night. Bronzes, with the name bronze coin, copper commons, and then silver nobles. So we have now, or if there isn't even a... if I'm not quite sure of the value of the silver pieces, or if there is another kind of coinage between the copper and the silver. But obviously, two silver pieces within the slum quarter would be an absolute fortune when the headsman Snaggle had joked about Gord getting a handful of coppers as if it were something impossible. We see that another inn has been named, the Wizard's Hat Inn, in a better section of the north part of the city. We're not really given any other information about the Wizard's Hat Inn, just the name, and this paragraph. And then we're also given a little information about what this area has in it. There's a dressmaker's, there's obviously at least a prosperous cleric. So we have gentlemen and clerics and their ladies and all the sense that this, and then finally the last thing I get out of this is that a courtesan is considered a woman of high station, and it shows you a little more about what the society of at least the city of Greyhawk and perhaps the whole Greyhawk campaign is like. All right, we are getting to the end of my reading. We're in the middle of coming to the end of chapter 4, but I'm not going to be able to finish it tonight. I think this is a pretty decent place to make an end for this reading. I really don't want them to be much more than an hour each in length. So, I don't know. Did you have anything more you wanted to comment on here?
Not particularly tonight. I didn't have a chance to read ahead, so I have less.
Sure. So, yeah, and this was, I mean, this particular section was heavily dealing with the Beggars Guild, the Beggars Union, I should say, and the plans that are underway for, and what they're doing confront and coming up against the Thieves Guild. So, as you can see, it's starting to reach out so that now we're starting to talk about more and more about the city of Greyhawk, and we're getting more campaign information that is greater than just what the Beggars Guild, the slum quarter, the old city, and the one of the great things about the Gord novels is that they are filled with small detail and tidbits of inspiring information, campaign information. It's not necessarily, you can see it's a very rough story in a sense. It's describing a very harsh place. And it probably is not what most people, it's not what I would run my campaign as, even though it reflects a certain reality. I run myself a bit lighter campaign, and any information that you find distasteful or out of place, very easily just say that's one person's campaign and my Greyhawk is different.
Right. One thing I was thinking of, do we know how much time passed between the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4?
No, we don't, and I've been commenting on that.
Yeah, I hear you mention it.
Gord seems to have changed considerably.
Right.
And the time from, the sniveling, crying, but still intelligent. And with that core of some core of strength within him. And definitely, the development, the nascent skills that, he uses later on. But he's 12 years old. Guaranteed he's 12 years old.
Okay.
At the time that he enters the Beggars Union, where he sold to Theobald. At this point, he does not seem to quite be a 12-year-old. Now, that is not saying much. They have Violet at 13 being a prostitute, and we have her only at 16 at this point. So we could have a little Anakin Padme thing here where Gord is much younger, than Violet. He could still be 12 years old. They have Hottie, who is a 7 or 8 year old, who is part of the elite group being trained as a beggar thief.
And Gord learns fast, we know that.
Yes, he's a fast learner. He only had one failure, and now he is their biggest earner.
Which is crazy. So
that's what, according to the book,
right.
He's bringing in the most coin. And he's now moved from the daily beggars to being part of the special group. He only goes out on these missions twice a week to gain the experience which he is then trained in, getting into that concept in the gaming concept that you get your experience and then you train, and you get your levels by the training, not just by the experience. Not how I ran my game, by the way. I didn't believe in that at all. I believed you could get a bonus experience by getting training. But I never gave, I never kept somebody back from leveling because they learned in a practical manner.
Yeah, like we would go to a weapons master or something and we would get better with a sword or something if we took some time and actually trained or something to that effect. A type
of sword. But really, I mean, real training is generally actual experience.
Right.
I remember what they did in Civil War. They had Irish immigrants coming to New York, and they would get them off the boat, and the men would be led right over to the recruiter, and they would be given given the uniform, the Union uniform, and led on a troop ship. And the Hessians during the American Revolution, the Germans rounded them up from farms and, cities and anywhere they could get these men and put them in a uniform, and when they got to this country, gave them a gun. And their training was right on the spot. I mean, the Hessians deserted in droves. you know, northern Jersey is filled with a German community that is, or was, filled with a German community that was descended from the Hessians who had deserted. And the casualties during the Civil War were so horrendous that they pale in comparison to practically, you know, any kind of modern casualties we take now, where they would have battles where 10,000 men died in an hour.
Right.
So, you know, it is, but it is definitely really learning to swim by throwing people into the deep end. But it is a sink or swim thing. And that experience, I've never liked that gaminess where, or the penalty of just, I really felt that if you were learning by practical experience, and I valued that more than training, and I myself would only give like a 10% boost in experience to getting paid training after the effect. So if you earn 10,000 experience points by practical means, you could earn an extra 1,000 by getting paid training. But I never did more than that, and I never required it as a way to level up.
Yeah, I don't think we had to do it. It was just optional.
See, it makes more sense when you get to something like wizardry, where they had to learn complex spells, where they would need to get training to learn the spells, than it does over a fighter, say, who would get the basic training and then learn to use that training in practical experience. If you never learned real combat, it's so much harder, and you're so much less experienced than somebody who has actually gone through physical confrontation or actually gone out in the field and learned the stresses to do this under stress, to do it under adverse conditions. And, you know, it's just, you know, I always, I think at this point I'm going to end the recording. Okay. Do you mind?
No.
You done?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me end it right here.